Angus Young, how you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl, how you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. Just wrapping up a splendor weekend. A few splendor sideshows happening before it all wraps up as well. This week, a massive episode about to come out on The Rider. I'm very happy to say next week, Billy Corgan. Wanna go
for a ride? Everyone, this is Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins. There's a man with a gun to my back, and he's making me say this. Becca.
Smashing Pumpkins, the new album is out, Atum, and we're going to talk to him next week. He's actually in a really good zone. He's engaged, he's got a couple of kids, and working on another Smashing Pumpkins album. So there's plenty more to come for the Pumpkins next week. Billy Corgan on The Rider with Becca.
This is The Rider.
This week, though, Leo Sayer.
The music star is marking 5 decades in the business with a huge UK tour. He's written a book.
Here is a gentleman who was a big star, who is one of the best singers in the business. Leo Sayer.
He has got a million stories. You will not believe the people he's met over the years, from starting off in London, moving to Los Angeles. A number of number one hits. And now he's an Aussie. Now, also, I'm going to ask about that particular song, Thunder in My Heart. That was remixed again in 2006, which also gave him a huge career boost back here in Australia, number one in the UK as well. There's so much to cover off with this absolute legend and bloody great bloke as well. Leo Sayer. Leo, how are you?
Hello, mate.
How are you?
How you doing? I've got two mics up here, actually. One is, would you believe, one is Tina Turner's mic.
No.
My old Neumann 87. This is the mic she actually recorded. What's Love Got to Do with It? Don't Need Another Hero. Everything on this exact mic. And I'm just enjoying using it for podcasting at the moment. The other thing is this new Rode podcaster. And it's a bit toppier, so
you'll see. I've got an RE20 in my hand, which is also
an RE20. Good for you, a lovely mic. Yeah, you sound real, and you don't need a pop shield because it's got such a good gauze on it. You know,
it's right.
Such a filter, really good.
Tell me about the story about the microphone, though. So how did that happen with Tina Turner?
Well, recently I've been working with a guy called John Hudson, who I've known for years, who used to run Mayfair Studios in the old days, which is where I used to record. Alan Tarney used to do a lot of stuff, all the mixes of and recording of a lot of our early tracks in the 80s came from there. And around about the 80s, Tina was recording there as well. So we used to share this mic because John just reckoned that it suited my voice and it suited her voice as well. You know, it could take a lot of punishment, take a high level, you know, because Tina was really a belter sometimes when she got going. And often they'd record just like I'm doing now without a pop shield. So I've started using it for podcasts and things like that and interviews that I've been doing. And everybody says, oh, God, it sounds amazing. So, so it's come out the studio because I've got a new mic in the studio now. But this is the actual one, that John sold me as soon as he came down to Australia. And now we work together because he moved down. He's got an Australian wife, Kate. And they moved down to Queensland. And I produce my own records, but I do all the mixing and mastering with John. He's an old hand. He's even older than me. I think he's 79 now. But my God, that guy got ears, you know? It's just incredible. And you'll find that all those Bryan Adams records, Run to You. What was the one in the movie? Oh, God, Robin Hood. Everything I do. That's all John.
Oh,
that's,
wow.
That's all John Hudson. So, you know, he's he's a hero, one of the best engineers in the world.
I just keep thinking about, you know, all it takes is one hit, one big song, you know, to propel yourself and just to have that ear. I don't know how people do it. I mean, Mark Opitz is a producer I look up to a lot because
Mark's a great guy.
He just changed the landscape of Aussie pub rock, you know. You look at all those big albums and
I think with an engineer, it can wake up something inside the recordist, you know, the engineer that says, hang on, this is the real thing. Mm. You know, it's not every day that you're presented with a voice like Tina's, for instance, you know, and I guess, well, John will say, I mean, it's not me being egotistical. He reckons I'm one of the best singers. So it's not every day you get a voice like that to work with. And you do see from my side of the screen, you know, you see people really raise their game. I mean, I had all the time when I was recording with Richard Perry in Los Angeles and making all those records, Endless Flight, Thunder in My Heart, you know, Howard Steele, that's right, who was a Texan engineer who used to build the desks he worked on as well. But he found me a great mic as well that, you know, just they find the microphone that will suit your voice and then they record you really like professionally and fairly and don't try to do any tricks. And, you know, I mean, I remember getting together with Mark and Mark sort of saying, oh, Michael Hutchence's voice, I'm scared to do anything wrong with it. You know what I mean? Because it's so easy to overdo it. You know, somebody else will get distortion. They'll try, oh, try this new Sony mic. Nah, back to the Neumann. You know, you've got to be really straight to get the best out of, you know, same with putting a microphone on an amplifier or on a drum kit. You know, you've just got to do it straight.
Exactly right, and we've failed many times when you mess around, even just in radio studios. You know, I've seen engineers who are tinkering around and want to change the microphones, yeah. And in the end, they just go back to Old Faithful, which is usually, you know, the RE20 or a Neumann. You know,
Look, we've all come straight around. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of clever things being done. You know, like all the way from synths to sequencers. And, you know, a lot of kind of paranoia about whether the track was in time or not. They used to have a machine called the Russian Dragon, which was very funny because it was a sync machine, basically. And it just checked whether your was going straight. And it was either rushing or it was dragging. So it became the Russian Dragon,
which I
thought was really funny. But that was kind of the paranoia because we were making very electric records at that time. And they all had to be, you know, which has led to the dance music that we have today. You know, it's a, you know, hip hop and whatever has to have an exact beat. You know, it can't stray away from 120 BPM and it's got to be dump, ka, dump, ka, all the way, you know.
Going back to Tina Turner, how did you reflect on the loss of Tina?
She's the story of rebirth, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose as a band, you'd have to look at Fleetwood Mac, you know, who came from that early time of Peter Green and Jeremy Spencer, you know, the original band, which was we all knew was absolutely incredible. Then they lost Peter. Then they went through years of into the boondocks. And all of a sudden, they find Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie and come back, you know. So it's a similar story. And Tina was really dead in the water. I mean, she recorded a song I wrote called Fool for Your Love just before she really broke out. And I was very honored because I got to know her in that time. We met in LA, you know, we hung out a bit when she came to London. So I was very lucky. I got close because of, you know, that song. Now that song wasn't the right one for her. Wasn't a big hit, but she recorded it and she recorded, you know, a couple of songs of mates of mine and things like that. And she was kind of fishing for a way in. You could see that very clearly. But she was as good as ever. The voice was as strong as it ever was. And her attitude, her chutzpah, and her determination, a single-mindedness, is what made it happen. But here's a funny story. I was offered What's Love Got to Do with It first before her. And I turned it down because I thought it was crap. I just thought it was a crappy little song. I guess it was the way the demo was or something. And the funny thing is, I met up with Tina at Mayfair Studios with John Hudson. And I said, oh, they wanted me to do this song. She said, which one's that? I said, oh, What's Love? She says, I've been offered that. She said, what do you think of it? Well, I call it the shit song. And so for years later, whenever I bump into Tina, she said, you know, I recorded the shit song, don't you? So that was our private little giggle. She was a very, very sassy, funny lady. I mean, you know, she had a bit of the Bette Midler's in her, you know, that she was a wicked sense of humor and she could find anything funny. It's no wonder she came out from under because she had this chutzpah, I say. But I mean, she had this attitude of let's kind of, you know, nothing would drag her down. She was determined, you know, and humor was a big part of it.
And, you know, the fact that Mark Knopfler wrote what Private Dancer as well. I mean, I couldn't imagine Dire Straits ever doing that song because it wouldn't sound right, you know.
I was around during that as well. I was friends with Mark. Mark is fascinated in Formula One, obsessed, you know. So I brought him along to the races at Silverstone. I introduced him to a driver called Stefan Johansson, who was driving Ferrari, Swedish driver.
Oh, yeah.
And, oh, man, they got on like a house on fire. So they were working that day on Private Dancer. It didn't have a final vocal on it, but I could tell there was something going on. And Mark and a couple of the guys in his band were in the studio, and me and Stefan were just sitting in, and I was just saying, that is a really good melody. He said, would you like to try it? And I said, yeah, okay. I never did, because then was a break and I had to go. Something happened, you know, but that was, and Tina said, I heard you were in on the sessions, you know, and that was it. The second major album, I think, that Tina made was Private Dancer, wasn't it? And that was the title track.
So you've got some incredible 6 degrees of separation, you know.
I know. Very lucky. Oh, yeah, look, you just have to be in the right place. I mean, because I was using Mayfair, the other people that were there were people like Tears for Fears. I used to hang out with Roland and all those guys, and some incredible records up there. Everybody Wants to Save the World, and that last incredible album, which had about 20 machines linked up, you know, because it was a massive thing. And Pink Floyd, Dave Gilmour was always there, you know. So you got to kind of sit down and hang with some lovely people. I remember when Stevie Wonder came in, we were chatting away like mad, you know, and look, it's just being in the right place at the right time. And my career has been all about that.
Now you're living in Australia. And by the way, we're so glad. And I remember I first met you when Thunder in My Heart Again came out. And it was 2006 from memory. I was living in Melbourne and you came in and the almighty Leo Sayer. You've made Australia your home. You've got married recently as well, by the way. Congratulations. And,
yeah, thank you. No, I always loved it here. I mean, it was just... This country's got something. It's got a mix between America and Britain for me. You know, it's always from the playing on stage kind of angle and making music, being in the music biz. It's got the enthusiasm of America, but the kind of relative sanity of Britain. I mean, when I came here, I just fell in love with this place because it's such a... I'd been to America first, okay? And the enthusiasm there always goes off the rails. You know, they're just... Everything's positive, but it's almost to the point of positive where it kind of corners on bullshit. So, you know, you get into this kind of thing in America where it's just too much. But Australia came to second as the big place, you know, foreign place to come to. And here, I don't know, the enthusiasm was there, the acceptance and the excitement was all there, but it was tempered with this kind of British logic. Oh, you know, let's not go too crazy. Let's not scare him off. So that's what I liked about it. And I think that it's all of that that persuaded me to come and live here in 2005 after, you know, many years of coming, visiting. I mean, so many visits, and I've made so many friends here. But it was logical to settle down here because I think this place suits my speed, you know, suits my mentality.
And also, it's just a little bit warmer as well, which is kind of nice. I mean, you're in the beautiful Southern Highlands. Yeah. It's a great spot. I mean, I'm assuming Jimmy and Jane are just down the road somewhere. Do you see them much?
They're just over the road. Yeah. We're good friends. And, you know, Jimmy comes down to see the studio every now and then, and I nip up to have a cup of tea with them. It's a nice musical capital here in the Southern Highlands. It's really great. We have the best of British weather as well, and quite a lot of palms here. So, you know, it's got a kind of pommy sort of atmosphere as well, which is quite nice. And only an hour and a half from Sydney, so that's cool.
Yeah, that's close enough. I wanted to sort of go back to the very beginning. You know, you met your co-writer. Was it Dave Courtney, was it? Is that who it was?
That's right, David,
and,
yeah.
And, yeah. You know, you wrote...
He likes to be called David. I'll tell you why, because there's a gangster in England, a very famous one, who was a bit of a bad boy called Dave Courtney. And he boasts all the time about knocking people's heads together or pinning them to the wall. So David likes to be called David now.
That makes sense. Fair enough.
That's 5 degrees of separation.
and you were writing for people like Roger Daltrey at the very beginning, and this is long before your hits came along, you know, many years before that.
We weren't, you know, Chris, we weren't really writing for anybody else. We were writing for Leo, but Roger... that came about because of a guy called Keith Altham, very famous music writer with an NME and, of course, publicist for so many acts. He's the guy who persuaded Jimi Hendrix to set fire to his guitar
Oh, wow.
In Monterey. Yeah, so he's quite a legend. He represented the Who at the time. He'd represented the Stones and the Beatles and just about everybody. And he wrote an article on me in 1973, or 72 rather, just before it all started, but the first major article. And Adam went to see him, Adam Faith, my manager, because at one time he represented Adam. And he said, you know, have you got any ideas? We're halfway through an album. And he said, well, Roger Daltrey, who I'm looking after this week, he said, has built a studio and he needs a guinea pig to go down and record in it. So Adam immediately said, okay, sounds good. And also Adam being a bit tight, I mean, it looks like I don't have to pay for that. So we went off down there, David Courtney, myself, and a few musicians we've been working with, Russ Ballard and Bob Henrit and a couple of guys from, used to be with Adam's backing band, and then we're in Argent at that time. And so we went down there and we sort of moved in over the way. Roger was great. He sometimes controlled the desk. You know, he was very proud of his studio. And we used to hang with him quite a lot, you know. He was just lovely and gave me so much advice. I mean, you know, this guy was a hero to me. It's like a young singer starting out now and Bruce Springsteen takes you under his wing, or, you know, it's like that. I mean, Roger was massive at the time. He was the quintessential rock god singer, you know. So to have this guy giving me advice, but then one day he turned around as well as that and he was sitting with me and Dave and he said, how about you write some songs for me? And we went, okay. But we didn't really have to write them, you see, because we were writing more songs than we could actually find time to record. We were that prolific. So we just gave him what we planned to be my second album. So Giving It All Away, One Man Band, all these songs were in this, and we handed them over to Roger and he loved every single one. And then came what I think was a really good executive decision. Because I'd nearly finished my record, my first album, Silverbird. And then Adam turned around and said, what about if we rush through Roger's album, get this done, because he's hot to trot, and I don't want him going off the boil, you know, and we put out Roger's album first, we hold yours up. And it was a brilliant decision, because then we had Roger going around the world saying, wait till you hear this guy, Leo Sayer. And it was just fantastic to have, as I say, the rock god, the greatest singer in music at that time, the Bruce Springsteen of his day, you know, singing my praises as an unknown. It was an incredible start.
That is exactly what you want as a young artist. And you're right. You obviously, this is all about strategy, and you thought, you know what, we'll let him do all the selling, and then we'll strike at the right time. And then in 77, you had two consecutive number one hits in America. I mean, it doesn't get much bigger than that.
I think Adam at that time had realized that he didn't have the skills as a producer, and he was quite open about it, that he needed to have to take me further than where I was. You know, I mean, the last album that I did with Adam before going off to Richard Perry was with Russ Ballard, who was a really excellent engineer as well as a producer. So they co-produced that together. And the standard, of course, went up, but we knew that it could get even higher. So Richard Perry had an incredible track record. And when I went over to see him, we didn't get on at first because he didn't really like my songs. But I suppose in a way we found some common ground. We played around with some kind of soul ideas and Motown kind of things because he was enamored with the voice. He thought, oh God, this voice, I can really do something with this voice. And I had this, you know, falsetto and a lot of really strong, rock, singing qualities, you know, so he wanted to make something of that. So he said, look, let's find the material that suits you and that is worthy of you recording. And I thought that was, you know, interesting. And I hung around and eventually, you know, in long sessions with all the musicians, of course, I started writing with them and writing with everybody I met there. And in a way, you know, there were four or five songs on that Endless Flight album that weren't supposed to be there, but there were songs that were undeniable, and Richard really went with them as well. And one of those was You Make Me Feel Like Dancing.
Did you ever have moments where you were thinking, okay, this is great in the studio when I've got a, you know, the high voice, but oh, bloody hell, I've got to take this on the road. I've got to sing like this every night.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, look, when I went to America and started working with Richard, all of a sudden I was working with, oh my God, musicians that were just the A-team, world-class. Jeff Beccaro, Steve Gadd on drums, you know, Larry Carlton, Lee Ritenour, and Ray Parker Jr. on guitar. You know, just amazing. Greg Fillinganes on piano and I don't know, David Paich and amazing musicians I was working with. And it kind of woke me up as a singer, made me think of possibilities. So, yes, I was immediately thinking of that. And on that first tour that we did after in 76, straight after the album had finished, I had Nicky Hopkins, the Rolling Stones keyboard player, in the band with me. And I had Bobby Keys, the sax player with the Rolling Stones, and Steve Maddeo, who'd run Stevie Wonder's band. So, boy, I had some incredible musicians on the road with me, you know. It was world class straight away. So, yeah, I rose to that challenge, I guess, of challenging myself to play with better and better players, you know, keep moving on.
You cross paths with some incredibly talented people, and that's the great thing about being in that muso scene in London, I can imagine. Like, yeah, you know, you are mixing with the Beatles and with the Rolling Stones and with those great session musicians you're talking about as well. And, you know, people like Ray Parker Jr. who would go on to, you know, have his own solo career, you know.
We wrote a few songs together, me and Ray, which was great fun because there was an incredible energy. I mean, we're still pals now, you know. So in a way, what happened in the 60s when I was a graphic designer, and we're going right back now, and I was just playing blues harmonica in clubs, I was very lucky because I'd look around and the guy playing next to me would be Eric Clapton or Keith Richards or Jack Bruce or Ginger Baker, or, you know, and that was incredible because even though I wasn't a name, they would kind of turn around to me and give me a nod, you know, accept me. A lot of people, we all played together in those days. And I think that prepared me because, all you know, after I'd played with them, I suppose they all became huge names. But at the time that I was, and when I was a graphic designer as well, I mean, I bumped into the Beatles a few times. I worked in a studio and Yoko Ono had a flat upstairs and John Lennon used to come down and I was smoking, he was smoking, and he'd offer me a toke on his joint. And we'd sit there and kind of, you know, and I'd say, so how's it going? You know, I didn't dare kind of allude to the fact that he was John Lennon. He wanted to be treated like a normal bloke. And he asked my name, you know, and I'd say, oh, Jerry. And he'd say, oh, well, I'll see you again, Jerry. So next day I'd go down there, oh, it's you again, you know. So we'd sit down together, have a smoke, just a normal thing. It wasn't a big vibe of fame in those days, you know. It was just a natural thing.
Yeah.
And I do remember later on when we were mastering my first album, Silverbird. This is in the middle of 73. We did it at Apple Studios in Savile Row. And I remember walking in one day to the studios, and this guy comes out and bumps into me wearing a huge, great big fur coat, and then turns around and says, oh, sorry, man. And then he looked back at me and it's John. He went, it's you.
Oh, wow.
And he remembered me, you know, and I said, yeah, Jerry, do you remember we used to have a ciggy in Marble Arch together? And he said, yeah. He said, how are you? I said, well, I'm making my first record. He said, what? I'm going to find out more about this. So he turned over my shoulder and shouted to one of the engineers who was just behind me. He says, is this guy making a record? He said, yeah, I want to hear it. Get me a copy now.
That's so good. Wow. So,
talk about being in the, you know, I mean, it's often you bump into people and things happen, you know, without you planning them. I mean, for instance, I always dreamed of meeting Bob Dylan, and I went to the first Dire Straits show in LA. I was living there at the time. It had to be about 79 or so.
Yeah.
And they're playing at the Roxy, or the Rainbow Room. The Roxy, it was called, the venue, and the Rainbow
Bar. Right next to the Rainbow. Yeah.
Yeah. So we go upstairs to the dressing room, and I'm with Jerry Wexler, you know, the Atlantic, Aretha Franklin's producer, and I'm with him, and he's kind of saying to me during the evening, he said, who would you most like to meet? And I said, oh, well, I dream of meeting Aretha, you know. He said, oh, I could fix that. And I said, but I really dream of meeting my complete and utter hero, Bob Dylan. And he said, oh, that's interesting. So we're walking up the stairs to meet to meet Mark Knopfler. And first time I met Mark, and a guy shuffles past me on the stairs and again bumps into me. And I didn't notice because I'm sort of in rapture that chatting with Jerry and, you know, concentrating on everything he's saying. And he said at the top, he said, you know, you said you wanted to bump into Bob Dylan. He said, you just did. he was leaving as I was going up the stairs. So I guess, you know, I did bump into my hero.
You did. And you know what? Sometimes it's positive because sometimes you don't want to actually get to know them. It ruins probably everything.
No. Although I adore Bob, you know, I'm sure we would get on great. You know, he's still my hero. But at least we rub shoulders, I guess.
Yeah, exactly right. and how were you affected by John Lennon's death at the time? Because that must have hit you fairly hard.
Well, I spoke to him about 2 weeks before because I was working with Bobby Keys, and Bobby was on John's solo albums, you know?
Yeah.
And we came into New York. I think You Make Me Feel Like Dancing had just gone to number one, so I was high as a kite at that time on on the success of what everything was happening. And I think from the lobby of the Plaza Hotel, don't forget we didn't have mobile phones in the time, Bobby just turns around to me. We were having a coffee or a drink or something, and he said, I've got to phone Lennon. He said, do you want to come? And I said, oh, yeah, say hello. And I said, oh, I'd love to say hello to John. And so he's on the phone. He says, hey, you know, John, I'm working with Leo Sayer. John says, oh, yeah, he's great. And he said, put him on the phone. Hey, Leo, it's John. He said, why didn't you come up and see us next week? He said, you know, we're doing the record and everything. And I don't know. He said, let's get together. It'd be nice to see you again. And I just said, yeah, I'd love to. Okay, I think I'm going to be in New York. But then something happened and I had to leave New York. I had to go back to LA, I don't know, TV show or something like that.
Yeah.
Bobby stayed on, you know, and it was the next week that Mark Chapman appeared and there was no more John Lennon. And he was an incredibly charismatic figure, although I'd say George and Ringo and Paul were just as charismatic in their own way. I mean, here were four guys that were, you know, proved to be incredible solo artists as well. But you can imagine that and you can see in the movie Get Back, you know, or Let It Be, you could see how close they were and how talented they all were, you know.
And it was amazing because you could see they all contributed in their own way, and you know, in that fly on the wall kind of style of the documentary, yeah. I just loved watching how each and every one of them, they all had a role. I mean, they got bored a lot waiting for, you know,
whoever. I think Yoko said that Ringo was often the glue that held them together, and that's very interesting, isn't it? She called him the most important member of the band. And I thought that was interesting.
That's a big, and
I did get to work with Ringo, which was fantastic. We did an album that Adam Faith started off for Lonnie Donegan. And Lonnie, you know, was an incredible hero to most British musicians all the way from Skiffle. And of course, you know, being the first British or English artist to really hit the charts in America with Rock Island Line in 53 or 55 or something like that. So he was a hero, and Adam wanted to do this record. So he put me in charge of phoning all the musicians and booking. I got everybody on that record: Elton, Ringo, Klaus Voormann, Brian May, Rory Gallagher. Oh my God. You know, it's just, you name it, they were all on it. And we put together some great bands, and the most fun I had was the day with Ringo in Larrabee Studios in LA, and we got drunk together later, but I'm playing harmonica in a booth and he's playing drums in the next booth, and the shenanigans that were going on between us was hilarious. He was just so much fun.
And you talked about your chance to hang out with Lennon more before he passed away. You also had a similar experience with Elvis. And this is one of the greatest and saddest stories I've ever heard in my life, because you went to number one in America, and I think it was around that time where Elvis had you on his radar.
77.
And what happened?
I fell off stage in a place called Alpine Valley in Wisconsin. Funnily enough, the same place that later Stevie Ray Vaughan flew into a mountain in a helicopter and died, the same venue.
Wow.
Around the same venue. Yeah, so this is a pretty fated place. But I was on tour. It was 1977. I remember it being incredibly busy. We were selling out lots of venues. We were playing all over the northeast coast of the States and into Canada, and all sold out shows, massive audiences, huge, huge thing it was, you know, and very hard to keep track with. And we got as far as this place, Alpine Valley, and it was a ski resort, and they'd built a big stage, and it covered quite an area in Wisconsin, which was a big fan zone, you know, for me.
Yeah.
And so a huge crowd was waiting for me to play. Melissa Manchester was the opening act, lovely songstress. And I went to check out her set because I hadn't had a chance to do sound check because I was busy doing some radio somewhere. And I leant against a curtain that I thought there was a barrier behind, and there wasn't.
Oh,
and I fell about 25, 26 feet onto my legs and my back. And, you know, for a moment, I thought I was dead. It was such a shock, you know. I was very honored that a lovely sound engineer called David Kirkwood jumped down after me and kind of held onto my, he put his arms around my shoulder, arm around my shoulders and another arm around my knees, and kind of held me together because I had a huge reaction. And he'd seen people fall off trusses, you know, in huge, great big gigs, lighting guys, riggers, you know, they call them,
yeah.
And sing guys fall off. So, you know, the first thing was that you had to get over to that guy and hold him together because the reaction, you could throw your spleen out of your body or your spine, you know, the delayed reaction. So he knew what to do. And I had that delayed reaction, and I came to kind of after that, because I was fairly unconscious when it happened. And they carted me off to a hospital, and we hit headline news. It was the lead story on all the radio news and television news. Singer Leo Sarah fell off stage yesterday and will be incarcerated in hospital undergoing tests. Oh, my God, you know. So I was the lead story. That just made more people come to the, you know, upcoming shows to buy tickets, you know. So
of course.
it was crazy. And I had to go on stage with a kind of wearing a weird kind of corset or a truss. To make sure that I didn't throw any ribs out, you know. And, oh, God, singing was really tough. I think I made it to about two or three extra gigs, and then we got down to Nashville, and luckily the gig was rained off, and I think I relaxed, but I might have relaxed too much because basically the shock wore off and I got a delayed reaction that came out in the dressing room of the next gig in Memphis.
Oh.
And it's a huge gig. Sold out, about 15,000 people or so. And I'm in the dressing room curled into a ball and I can't get out. You know, nobody knows what to do with me. My ex-wife Janice, who was usually on the road, she'd gone back to LA because she thought now everything was okay, better look after the house. And I was on my own with my crew and all of my guys, but a huge, great big guy, ex-Miami Dolphin footballer, came stumbling into the room and said, I know how to look after him. I know what to do. Because, of course, these football guys, you know, American football, they'd seen all the, you know, twist necks back in and arms and all.
Oh, they've done it all. Yeah.
Yeah, they got it all. They know the therapy, you know. And this guy just took me, you know, picked me up in his arms, put me in his Jeep and drove me off 100 miles up to Huntsville, Alabama, where he gradually worked me out of, you know, the problem that I was in, got me back. You know, I was in a swimming pool and doing exercises. And I knew he worked for an important guy in town because he'd put together an incredible gym. And I said, how do you afford to do this? He said, I've got a big backer, you know. And I said, who's that? And he said, I can't tell you. And that's all he'd say, you know, I can't tell you. Secrecy. Yeah. So I don't know. I wormed it out of him one day. Well, I kind of thought I did. And then he said, okay, look, I'll phone him up. And he went to the phone and he handed me the phone. And on the other end was Elvis Presley.
Oh, wow.
Just, you know, and I thought there's a guy called Terry O'Neill, very famous photographer who photographed me many times. You'll have seen his photographs, I'm sure. And photographed me right from the start. And he was a good pal, but Terry used to have this awful thing where he'd phone me up and pretend to be people like Bob Dylan. And he'd have me going for hours, you know. And I'd go, "Oh, Bob, yeah, I really want to see you." And he'd go, "It's me, Terry, you stupid fool." So I don't know. I was being pranked all the time. So the first thing I said, "Oh, bloody hell, it's Terry." And he said, "Oh, please don't use profanities with me, sir. This is Elvis Aaron Presley." And as I looked over the other side of the room, Michael is nodding his head. So it really was him.
Oh, wow.
And we talked for about, oh, God, what is it, 45 minutes or 50 minutes? And he seemed really excited and invited me over to the house the next day. So we were going to hang out. He said, "Look, if you've got a few days, let's hang out, make some music, do some things. You know, I've been following your career and all this stuff." And he said, "You really do make me feel like dancing." And I could hear a giggle in the background. And that was his girlfriend, Gina. And later on, she said he was so thrilled that night that he was going to meet you. But from then, everything kind of went a bit pear-shaped, because the next morning, I was recording off the, I had this wonderful, early for its time, Sony cassette recorder. Yeah. Mm. So I, radio cassette recorder. So I used to record all the gospel shows and things like that, all the old blues and country on the radio. And I've still got this recording, actually. And suddenly they cut in with the singer, Elvis Presley, has been brought dead on arrival to Memphis Baptist State Hospital.
Oh.
And that was it. And Michael, the guy that had been, you know, working for Elvis and started the gym, came running into the room. He said, "Did you hear that?" Because he heard it as well on his radio. And he said, "Look, I got to go. And I'm so sorry." And that was it. I never got to meet Elvis. I never got to spend that time, which would have been golden, you know.
What a story.
Straight after it happened, you know, this adventure with Elvis that never came to fruition, I couldn't tell anybody about it. I mean, they'd never believe you. I mean, what, you know, Leo Sayre from Shoreham by Sea in Sussex, okay, just had some wonderful success, but in America, but oh, Elvis was in another league. So I kept it quiet for years and years. I never told a soul. I told my ex-wife Janice, but, and my manager Adam, of course, knew, but nobody else, nobody else. Everybody was sworn to secrecy on it. And, it wasn't until sometime in the 80s that I suddenly got an invite to go to dinner in London with David Foster. And I thought, David Foster, this is incredible. Maybe this is a break. He wants to produce me. Because we had worked together very, very briefly. He'd played keyboards with me.
Yeah.
You know, early days of the seven, of the times with Richard Perry, because he was a keyboard player. So I thought, oh, you know, what a piece of luck. But it turned out he had a girlfriend, and that was Ginger Alden, who was Elvis's last girlfriend. Now, she was terrified of flying, but she heard from David, because they just got together, you know, at this time, that he was going to come to London. She said, "Look, I've got business to do. I've got to see Leo Sayre." And David immediately said, "I know Leo Sayre." He said, "Well, do you think you could arrange a meet?" "Yeah, sure I could, you know." So they flew over, and through my publisher, I get this invite. And then I sit down. I didn't expect Ginger to be there. And she just turned around, looked at me, and burst into tears. And I thought, what's going on? And of course, I'd heard of her. And she said, "You were the last person to talk to Elvis. And when Elvis went to bed," she said, "I didn't even see him, but I could hear him going up the stairs singing 'You Make Me Feel Like Dancing.'"
Oh, my God.
So what a story. Eh? And she said, "I just had to tell you, I've been keeping this to myself." She said nobody else was there that night. You know, of course, that dodgy doctor came around later, which is, you know, the cause of death probably. But she said I was the one who discovered him in the morning, doubled over on the loo, you know, and he was dead. But she said, you know, the last words I hear him say was, "Leo's coming, Leo's coming." And then he's singing, you know, can you imagine Elvis singing "You Make Me Feel Like Dancing"? That's with me, you know.
But again,
the legacy forever.
It's a legacy forever. But I mean, it just shows that the impact you had, in the States, yeah, in 77. I mean, it's something you must sit back and think, I can't believe it happened, you know.
Well, I've had a funny old career, because often what I've done is not recognized. And I don't say that in any bitterness. It's just peculiar, you know. And I think probably it's because I don't want to join in all the BS of this business often. I stay just outside it. I like my normal life. You know, I like to go shopping at Coles and Harris Farms. I don't really want to be sitting in limousines, you know. So I do live a very normal life. And every now and then I'm reminded, oh my God, that I did all these things and that I saw all these things, and some of these things are still going on. You know, it's incredible. I feel there's duality in my life, which is interesting, because I think like Gerard Husea, my real name, and but I happen to be Leo Husea. So there's this dichotomy going on, you know.
Well, that's part of the great thing about living where you are, you know, the Southern Highlands. It's out of the glitz of Sydney, and you can just pop down to Coles and Harris Farm, you know, and do all that sort of stuff.
Did you just get back
from a tour of England fairly recently as well?
Yeah, we did. We did a tour last year, the end of last year, which was fantastic because it was like 50th anniversary. That was fantastic. But I've also been in the States earlier this year as well. We did a few gigs out there. And so I'm really pushing to get myself back to the States. And, you know, I hadn't toured there since 1984. So that's how you go missing sometimes, you know?
Yeah. It is a different world over there. And
It is. But it was fantastic going back. The reaction to the shows, the reaction on stage was just amazing. And they're all telling me I can still sing. I've still got the hair, still got the moves. You know, so it was very exciting, and hopefully we're going back, maybe not the end of this year, but early next year. So we'll attack it all again. But it's kind of unfinished business for me that I've got to get back to the States because that was my biggest market at one time.
Your fans back then are probably still going to the gigs now, and they're bringing their family with them, you know.
Well, they did, and the people came. You know, we played in this place in Florida, and people came from Boise, Idaho, and from Canada, from Mexico, and it was incredible, all these kind of dedicated fans coming to the show, and it was like a second coming, you know. It was very exciting.
Now, it's interesting you live so close to Jimmy and Jane. It was in the early 90s when, you know, Jimmy was living down in Barrel with, you know, the family, and the tin lids were growing up, but he went through some terrible financial problems at the time. And I remember we all were aware of it as Aussies.
We all have done in this business. Yeah.
Well, we have. And I know you have too.
I was ripped off very heavily.
Yeah.
About three times by nefarious managers, you know. But I guess it's the game, you know. The big challenge is surviving all of that. And I'm glad I have. I'm quite comfortable now. And, you know, thanks to American partners who look after me and share my royalties with me, we have got quite a nice base to make music from. And I've also taught myself how to make records. So that is an incredible thing to be able to do. You know, I've now made about three or four albums completely by myself. And I guess, you know, they've been picked up pretty reasonably by people, but they're not small productions. They're big productions, and I love making records. And I've had some great teachers, of course, because Arif Mardine, Richard Perry, you know, John Hudson, of course, Alan Tarney, you know, David Courtney, Adam Faith, Russ Ballard. So many incredible producers have been able to teach me the ropes, and I now love making records.
Well, that's really good because I could imagine it could go down the path of you see the whole experience of making records being a traumatic experience because it brings back memories of being ripped off countless times. And it must be hard to put trust in people particularly with your finances, because you can't do your own billing and do your own invoices and stuff when you're an artist.
No, this is the thing. You have to. I mean, I've been very lucky in having my partner and wife, Donatella, because when we were really up against it and had the worst ripoff, when a guy was forging my signature on contracts all over the world and basically stealing everything from me and selling it off to other people, which took years to get right, Donatella was there for me and really learned, understudied with managers and with accountants and with music business agents and promoters, and they all gave her information, and she just stored it up and became my manager for a time. And we worked our way out of this situation, you know. That's what you do. I'm sure that's what Jane has done with Jimmy many times. It's pretty obvious, you know.
Oh, it is.
You take charge, you know, and you know, you trust the people closest to you, of course. But it is a big mechanism, this business. There's sharks out there, and it's very hard. And it's sometimes also hard to get recognized. I mean, the ARIA organization here doesn't think I exist. I've never been invited to the show, even though I had a number one record here with More Than I Can Say. Every time I kind of try and make any ovation to them, they just run away. The same with the Ivors in England. As a songwriter, you know, and I think I've had as many successful songs that I've written, but that's life. You know, sometimes it takes years to catch up. It does. And if you have a few ripoffs, you are playing catch up. This is the way the industry works, you know.
I learned something yesterday. I forgot that you're part of a Cockney slang if you're doing a Leo Sayer.
A Leo Sayer, an all-dayer.
An all-dayer.
There's actually, there's a hockey club apparently in Southampton in England called the Leo Sayer All-Dayers. And I've yet to meet up with them, but they keep sending me messages. I must do that.
You have to. You have to do their awards night one year to surprise them. Just turn up, you know.
Apparently, there's another thing, Leo Sayer syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when you stick your fingers in the light socket and your hair goes electric.
It is certainly a distinctive look. Like you, if you're heading down to Harris Farm to get the veggies, you're going to stand out. People must come up to you.
I know. I get recognized everywhere. I mean, still having this hair, which is quite remarkable at 75, you know, to not be balding at all, you know. Well, probably a little patch at the back, but it's well covered. No, but my hairdresser says, you're not. And I'm paranoid about it, of course. my dad died with a full head of hair at 73. So I guess, and I've outlived him. So basically the hair is still there. I suppose it's a legacy from dad. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell you what, you're bloody lucky. Mine's, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It does. But I'm very lucky. I'm very hip, fit for my age. I've just had some blood tests and all that sort of stuff, you know. And they just said I'm fit as a 40-year-old, you know. So I don't know. I get a feeling that I'm in my best years now. And anything carrying on from here, I can still sing at my utmost and still powerful, and I could still move on stage, not as much as I used to. The falsetto's still there. So I reckon that there's still room for me to do things.
Before we go, let's just talk about quickly,
yes,
Thunder in My Heart again. How did that remix happen? Because that, to me, was a massive reinvigoration of your career. It seems that you've had multiple moments throughout the years where you've been, you know, given a bit of a slingshot moment almost, and that one just exposed you to the masses once again.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I was actually leaving Amersham in Britain, in Buckinghamshire, packing up all my stuff in my studio there to come to Australia, and just about to leave England. And one of the last things, I go to the post, you know, the last time, thinking, okay, after this, everything's going in the container and it leaves and there's no point going to the post office anymore. I'd already said, send it on somewhere else, you know. And they said, well, this package did come. So I take out the package and it's a CD, and I put on the CD. And it was the first version of the mix. And I went, what? You know, I literally fell over. I couldn't believe it. And what had happened was a guy called Craig Demek, who ran a dance label, had somehow found Thunder in My Heart. You know, somebody had played it to him, or else he picked it up in a store, an old record or something like that, put it on and thought, my God, this deserves a remix. And he tried to do some things with it, but he couldn't really get on with it. He couldn't really get anything done. So he chose a team called Bimbo Jones. And I've worked with them many times since. A DJ called Lee Dagger, who I've written a lot of songs with, is part of that group, and his mate Mark JB. And it was them that put the mix together and managed to somehow, I mean, you hear all about McCartney talking about AI, you know, in separating John's voice, but really it's all electronic filtering. And what they do is they filter out the bass and drums and change the speed of the record. This is what happened with Thunder in My Heart. Sped it all up, separated the voice and made that really clean. They had to live with all the strings because there was no multi-track. They only had the two-track stereo mix, the single off from 1977 to work with. So they managed to somehow speed it up, just cut certain bits of the song so it wasn't the whole thing. And they came up with this amazing mix. And when I first heard it, I contacted Craig immediately, and he said, oh, you better speak to those guys. So I talked to them, Mark and Lee, and gradually it started to get put together. I didn't have to sing anything again. It was quite remarkable. And when they finished it, it was just a monster. They promoted it in a very weird way. They didn't put my name on the label. They just kind of sent it out as what they called a white label. It went to dance clubs all over England. And of course, it got so much attention because it was a real killer tune. And it went to number one in the first week it was released in England. It went straight into number one. And by that time, everybody said, oh, that's Leo Sayer. Because a few Radio 1 DJs in England remembered who it was, and they blew it. You know, they blew the news on it. They sort of said, that's Leo Sayer. It was Thunder in My Heart from 1977, because they were trying to make it a mystery. I even had, you know, there was press going, he's somewhere lost in Australia, and he doesn't even know this is being released. Rubbish. You know, I had to okay the thing, you know, because I own it, basically. And, yeah, there you go. It was a massive hit. Very strangely, they never released it in America, and I think it would have been a number one there. And I still think there's a chance that it could get released there, you know. So I don't know. It's one of those wonderful things. It brought me back to a young audience, and certainly it was, you know, gave me a second official number one in the UK. So it was a fantastic thing. And I believe it did pretty well down here in Australia as well. Got lots of airplay. So, I was reborn.
Yeah, I could vouch for that. It originated, I think, in Melbourne, because Melbourne had a huge dance scene back then. And,
That's right.
Just went out from there. Yeah. All the radio stations picked it up, and you were flown out, and I think it did all the promo for it. And
I was already here, actually.
Oh, you were already in Australia.
I was already. Yeah, I just moved down when it happened, and I remember, I think it was the Telegraph or somebody phoning me up saying, "We've got to do a story on this. You're number one." And I didn't even know they got the information before me. So all of a sudden, here am I trying to sell some gigs with my new band down here. And suddenly everything became rather easy.
That definitely helped it out. Well, look, Leo, it's so good to catch up with you tonight. And actually, before you go, can you tell me, because it is the rider, we always ask what is your rider backstage. What is your drink of choice, Leo? What is it when you're touring?
Well, it's going to be beer after the show, and I'm impartial to Mexican beer, Dos Equis. It's got to be that.
Ah, yes.
So there'll be a crate of Dos Equis. I can't drink before the show, but I'll drink after. I make my own drink during the show, for the show, which is ginger and lemons and honey, and that's part of it. But basically, I'm a man of simple tastes. As long as there's some food to eat somewhere, and, you know, nobody bothers us too much. We can get on with what we're doing. The rider is pretty simple.
Well, Leo, once again, thank you so much. Great having a chat. It means a lot. And we will see each other face-to-face very soon, okay?
Absolutely, Becco. A real pleasure talking to you, and I really enjoy this podcast. Got to say, both Donna and I, we laughed till we cried at Mike Chugg's podcast. Oh, did you know he was my first tour manager?
I didn't know that.
And Chuggy was so funny. And every time I'm getting together with him, I tell everybody, of course, that he was my tour manager. And he says, no, I wasn't. I was co-promoter. Because his ego is too big to flatten that one.
Leo Sayer on the rider. Make sure you keep an eye on his socials. He'll be doing some touring around the country and working on some new music as well, as you heard. Next week on The Rider, I reckon one of the biggest guests I've ever had. A guy who shaped all our teenage years with some incredible Smashing Pumpkins albums. Next week, Billy Corgan. We'll catch you then.